Hi, I'm Alison Canavan and you're listening to the Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, with a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list though, wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days, 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it, you've got to keep giving yourself challenges.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Breffni Early Show, where each week we bring you some of the most inspirational, motivational and interesting guests from around the country and further afield. This week I am delighted to say I am joined by a good friend, someone who I've got to know over the last few months and who I find ticks all of those boxes as we do every week, or at least we try to do every week. I'm delighted to welcome to the show author, model, alcoholic...
Recovered.
Alison Canavan.
Recovered alcoholic.
I don't normally put in the negatives, if you can call it a negative, in the introduction, but I think it's something we're going to talk a good bit about over the next 45 minutes or an hour or so. So I want to just kind of get it out there nice and early. But first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to talk about your book. You're going to talk about your gratitude journal. We're going to talk about your dealings with alcoholism. We're going to get to all that over the course of the next... hour-ish. But first, I want to talk about teenage Alison, going to school in Dublin and getting into the whole modelling thing. What was life like for you as a, say, 14, 15-year-old girl?
Well, I went to Mount Sackville, close by here, for a first year, and then I transferred and went into Pembroke School in Waterloo Road, which was the school for young ladies. It's since closed down. It was a fantastic school. It really was. It was great. It was very small classes and all the girls were very close. When I was about 15, my mum entered me into a competition and I ended up winning it. It was Head to Toe. I don't know if you remember Head to Toe.
I do remember. No, I wasn't a fan, but I remember the show all right, yeah.
So I won that and then I went to London and then I won the Irish Heat for the Ford Supermodel of the World competition the next year. So I went to Las Vegas to represent Ireland in that. I did very well and I went straight to Paris. And never look back. So that was when
all this was what age?
Oh, just between 15 and 16.
Wow.
Yeah. Because you were supposed to be 16 for the Head to Toe competition, but I wasn't. I was 15.
So you were the Nadine Coyle of her time. Has that come out since? Yes.
I don't know. I'd say I said it years ago. We're a long way from that now. I'm 38, so I doubt anyone cares. But yeah, so when I was 16, really, I was working in London and Paris. And when I left school, I moved straight to London for work.
So modelling, all that sort of work?
Yeah, just modelling. Yeah, I worked in London. I worked all over Europe. I lived in, I travelled everywhere. It was amazing. I travelled all over the world. And then in my mid-20s, I moved to New York and I stayed for 8 years. And from there, I travelled all over the States and went to South Africa for a while. I worked in Australia and Sydney and went to do a commercial in New Zealand and stayed for a few months. And I just used the opportunity I had as a model. I love travelling. Travelling is one of my biggest joys.
Explain to me a little bit about the world of a model, because I think we see the pictures at the end, which are after weeks and months and of work, but what's a normal day, or is there such a thing as a normal day?
There's no such thing as a normal day. Every day is different, but the days that you're not working, and by that I mean booked for a shoot or a commercial or a job or traveling, you're doing castings. So you'd be doing between 8 to 10 castings a day. Which means, like, for example, we used to have no phones back in the day. So when I was in Paris and I was like 16 years of age, I was given a map of Paris and a list of appointments printed out. And there you go, off on your own for the day. And remember, there was no phones. Like today you can call the agency and go, oh God, I'm lost, help me, you know. So it was literally figuring out your way around cities, how to get to each place, trying to be on time. And it was absolutely exhausting from that perspective. People always go, oh yeah, it was so exhausting. Poor you, you're a model. But, you know, I don't think people see the hard work that goes into behind the scenes. It's extraordinarily competitive. Like being a model in Ireland is, you know, there's very little competition. There's very few girls who are models. And you go to a casting and there might be like 15 or 20 of you. But you go abroad and you pick up a number and you could be number like 400 or 500, or they could be casting all day and you have an allotted time slot, or they could be casting for days for a specific job. So, you know, it's a totally different ball game. It's a totally different ball game for you, for your mental health, for, you know, waking up every day. I suppose, and being judged on what you look like as opposed to anything you have to say is tough. You know, I didn't realize how tough it was until many, many years later. And I reflected on sitting in a room with, you know, the most beautiful girls you'll ever see. Like, I will say that, like, you know, you're just sitting there going, wow. Like, I just remember I used to stare at some of the girls because they were just so gorgeous, you know. But everybody abroad, I will say one thing about the industry, were so nice. Like, all the girls were so supportive. Like, when you get onto the world stage in an industry like this, it's a game changer. Like, the nastiness, the superficial, the bitchiness kind of is gone. You used to meet the same girls in London, Paris, New York and Milan because you'd be doing the circuit of shows. So you used to meet the same girls everywhere, and it becomes like teamwork, you know. And like anything, if you learn to work as a team, you'll do better at your job. So, yeah, so it was great opportunity. But like everything, it has its dark sides.
Before we get to the absolute dark sides, I want to talk about rejection, because that must be a huge part of dealing with that. And like, I was never a teenage girl, but I know teenage girls don't deal well with rejection.
Yeah.
So how did you cope with that as a 16-year-old, 17-year-old?
You know, there's a certain element of it that it is like water off a duck's back, because you have to be like that.
From the start?
To be honest with you, I think as human beings, we don't really understand, and we're not really aware of how things are really affecting us, because it goes into our subconscious, it goes into our central nervous system at a level that we're just not aware of. And it is tough when you go into castings. Like, I remember being in Paris and, you know, showing my book for Fashion Week, and the woman would take your book, put it on the table. Some people wouldn't even open it. They talk to the person beside them and then hand it back to you. And you'd say, you didn't even open my book. I'm finished. Then other people would flick through it whilst talking to someone else. So they wouldn't even look at one picture. So, you know, there was many, many different things that you came up against. So, it was really tough from that perspective. And it wasn't until years and years and years later that I started to really understand. And I mean, many years later, in my late 20s, that it was never about me, the rejection. It was like when a client is looking, like when they're doing fashion shows or when they're doing a shoot, they have a very specific look in mind. So they want 10 girls with, you know, long, dark hair and brown eyes and, you know, something like this. So if you don't tick their box, it's nothing personal. You know, it's just literally you're not fitting the criteria for what they want. So there's certain things like that I wish I was told earlier on in the game, you know, because you do take things very personally and you make it about you. And you, if you don't get a job, and my mum used to say to me, oh God, you're down to the last two again. You know, I see that as a great positive now, like in hindsight, but I was always down to the last two or three, like it just for really, really, really big, big campaigns. Like, we're talking massive money. And you go back and you do recall after recall after recall. But what I realized towards the end, like for the Lux job that I did get, and it was the face of Lux worldwide. I don't know if you remember it, LUX. So it was the biggest selling beauty product in all of Asia and all of India and all of those type of countries. So I was huge down there. And,
well, they're small in China, so you're tall. So yeah, everyone's big in China.
And I remember being in Cuba actually and seeing me all over this shop that sells soaps and bath products and everything. It was pretty surreal.
Did anyone recognize you?
No, when I was in my 30s, my sister was like, oh my God, look, we went for my 30th birthday and I was all over this shop. I was like, this is so bizarre in Cuba, like to see yourself all over everything. But like, I remember when I went for that day and we did actually a shoot with this amazing photographer, and the other girl was blonde. So they did the shoot with both of us. And I ended up winning the campaign. But really that day was like, wow, they were shooting two totally different people to see how it came out, you know. So it really wasn't anything personal. It was like they wanted to get a feel for who suited the type of campaign they wanted. But, you know, I've learned an awful lot from the industry I was in. Like, as my father used to say, God rest him, a life on the streets is better education than you'll ever get in school, you know. So traveling around the world at a young age, meeting different people every day, understanding how the world really works, you know, all that kind of interaction really helped me to grow as a person.
At what point did it become the norm for you to drink and take substances?
Oh God, always. Like, from very young age, like I started drinking. But like, you know, I was only talking to this about yesterday to someone. I started drinking heavily in Ireland, you know, like in my friends all drank, like going to the local disco here, you know. That was long before I went into modelling. Modelling just made it easier to do it. and nobody to ask any questions. But when I came home, my friends were partying equally as much as anybody in the fashion industry. So it wasn't the fashion industry that, you know, that led me down the path of that lifestyle. It was just a lifestyle where there was more parties more often. You were going out during the week, whereas everybody was just going out here at weekends. So really, for me, you see, I always suffered from low mood in the morning. And I always say low mood because I was never really in a bad mood. And that's what people don't really understand. I just found it very difficult to get going every day. But I just thought that's the way human beings were. I thought that's the way everybody was because it's all I ever knew. And then when I drank, that was gone. Like when I had a glass of wine or when I had a drink, that all of that weight I seemed to be carrying just lifted. And that's the only way I can describe it, you know. But what happened as the years went on was the moods got lower and more difficult to kind of control, you know, more difficult to pull myself out of that dark place. And then I started to develop bad anxiety. So the only way to cope with it was to self-medicate, because medication for me never really worked. And, you know, they used to medicate me for the side effects of medication. It's like, as they do with everybody, you know. Sure, if you're finding it difficult on your antidepressants, we'll give you a sleeping tablet. You know, if you're finding it difficult to travel, we'll give you some Xanax for the plane. You know, take the Xanax before you fly to prevent yourself from having an anxiety attack. Take the Xanax before you go on the subway, you know, so you won't have an anxiety attack. So that's all I knew. Like with the amount I know now and the amount I've studied, I just think it's just bonkers that people are even, like, we talk about, you know, nobody's allowed to give out information unless they're qualified. Well, all the people giving out wrong information to me over the years were considered to be the best qualified people in the world. So I have a big question mark over all of this. Oh, you can't say this unless you've studied to be a doctor for 7 years, you know. I think, you know, we need to...
I think questioning the substances you put in your body is something that more of us should do...
All the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
I'm very slow to take anything, even if it's a...
Pharmaceuticals are so normalised. So normalised anyway. You go to the doctor and they write a prescription just in case they think you have a chest infection. Now, I know people will say that some of that's changed, but by and large, prescriptions are written far too easily. You know, far too easily. It's like, we'll just give you, how many times have you gone to the doctor and you've heard, I'm just going to write a prescription just in case. And you can fill it if you want to. You know, like, it's just, it's for me, I just think, you know, we need to look at the bigger picture. And there's loads of different factors that have contributed to this, time being the most, you know, we are time poor in this world. And that's why I keep saying,
we choose to be time poor.
We choose to be time poor, but the world is moving faster. We're living in a digital age. Things are moving faster. Life is busier. More is expected of us, and people feel the need to keep up with that. But I do think we're now coming to an age where we've got it, like I always say, slow down to speed up. Slow down to speed up. You have to consciously take time, small moments often. And then you'll be able to cope with the demands that society has on us. But the thing is that we've decided that we're going to try and keep up with the fast pace of the world, but we're not doing anything to nourish ourselves in any other way. So our central nervous systems are constantly in fight or flight mode. You know, our barometer for stress. You'd often talk to somebody who's really busy. Are you stressed? No, God, I'm not stressed at all. So I think our awareness of what stress is bonkers as well. Like, I'd say most of us are between a 7 and 10 when we should be a 3 or a 4 without even realizing it. So I think we're all living with low-lying stress all the time, and it's wreaking havoc with our bodies. And then what happens is it presents in a way of, like, you know, skin rashes or digestive issues or different inflammatory conditions, you know, headaches and acne on your skin and all of these things. And we go to the doctor and we present with these symptoms and we're treated for those symptoms. But if you dig deeper, stress is probably the root cause, you know, of most of these issues that's going on. So I'm a big fan of digging and digging and digging and digging, which is something I've done for myself over the last few years. So I think we've got to keep digging deeper to get to the root cause of the problems. Otherwise, we're just putting sticking plasters on things.
You talked about qualifications there, and you also talked about how you went straight from school into the world of modelling. Yeah. I know you're a big fan of self-development over the last few years, and I listened to another podcast as part of the research of this, and you talked about how you were always doing a course, so much so that your mother and family kind of used to poke fun at you for the fact that you were always starting a new course. What's the current direction for you?
Well, I'm still in college studying to be a nutritional therapist. But I'm doing it because I want more information on the stuff that I'm interested in, you know. So I'm always studying. I'm finishing my NLP. I went back to college and did PR, marketing, sales management, lots and lots of different things. I did a business course a few years ago. I'm a great believer in education, but I'm also a great believer in keeping an open mind. Nobody knows everything. And I think once you do train in something, you have to keep upskilling and upskilling and upskilling and upskilling. Like if you trained to be a doctor or indeed a dietitian or a nutritionist 20 years ago, you can be damn well guaranteed that a lot has changed since then. So the problem I have is people not keeping up with what's going on. You know, we're never going to know everything. You know, things are changing at an alarming rate. You look at science now. Physics is proving, you know, that there's different dimensions and all of these things that we never thought possible. So I think as human beings, we become very limited, you know, by what we learned at the time. I think science is amazing, but science changes over time. If we were all still living by what science said 50 years ago, you know, things would be very different. So I'm just a great believer in keeping an open mind and really learning from each other. Like the one thing that upsets me, I suppose, since I've gotten into the world of wellness and self-development is, you know, everybody seems to be attacking each other rather than working together. You know, it's like, you know, dietitians are better than nutritionists. And it's like, you know what, maybe we should work together because we're trying to make people feel better. You know, we're trying to get people to live happier and healthier lives. You know, I read an article in The Guardian the other day and the journalist to me just seemed, it really was bitter grapes, sour grapes, if you ask me. She tore apart the Hemsey sisters and all of those girls and said that they were, you know, very privileged, beautiful young girls who were thin. And I thought, wow, you know, these are young girls who when I was young, I would have absolutely adored to have had girls who were so healthy and vibrant. And I can't remember the last time somebody was rushed to hospital for eating a lovely, brightly coloured, healthy salad. You know, it's like people are dying every day from eating the wrong food. Depression, anxiety is an all-time high. And I think, you know, these girls are doing something different. When I was young and modelling, it was like the heroin chic era. Like it was like I never even heard someone mention health or wellness or gym or drink water or do anything. So I celebrate these young girls. I think these young girls are absolutely incredible to have. They're in their young 20s. They're showing young girls that you can be healthy and happy and live an amazing life. So, you know, we're getting all these people coming out now and they're attacking clean eating and what is that and all of that kind of stuff. And I just think, why are we trying to take down people who are trying to do something good? You know, we're trying to get people healthier. We're trying to get people happier. And this whole, you know, idea that, you know, one person knows more than another person knows more than another person. It's like when you work together, great things happen, you know, and we're all, surely we're all in this industry for the same reason, you know, to better ourselves, to better each other, to make a difference in the world, you know. So it's an interesting time, that's for sure.
Let's talk alcohol for a minute, because I know that's something that has played a major part in your life over the last 25 years or so. What are the worst moments? What were the low points of your relationship with alcohol?
God, there were many low points. I suppose, like, I always self-medicated in many different ways, like with prescription medication and, you know, with alcohol. So I was the person who never wanted the party to end. I was the person who would do anything to have another drink and to stay up late. And Party Alley was a real identity. In fact, it was the only identity some people knew. And I was great fun, you know, like everybody wanted me at their party. You know, if it was in New York and people were like, come on, Ali, come on, we have to get Ali to come. She's great fun and she'll entertain everybody. But that started to come at a really high cost, you know. So it was great fun in the beginning. And, you know, it was kind of like we all show off and we're young and stupid. And we're like, oh, my God, I stayed out all night last night and I went to work and I was absolutely perfect. And, you know, the shoot turned out amazingly. And that could have been my greatest downfall. Because I think if it had affected me in a negative way, if I had looked like shit on a job, then I probably would have looked at my behavior a lot more closely and the agency probably would have as well. But, you know, I grew up in a time where it was completely acceptable. Like people were completely bonkers in my industry. You know, it was a kind of anything goes. As I got older, I started to get away with it less and less. And I missed only a handful of jobs, but they were enough. They were big jobs and they were enough to let me know that I had a problem, because I always used to kind of use the phrase, oh, well, I've never missed a job or I've never done this. So, you know, you'll justify anything to yourself when you have an addiction problem. And my family used to say to me, and I would always have a story, and you believe the story you tell yourself as well, you know. But running alongside this, like, I was always a spiritual soul seeker. So I was always big into spirituality, and I've meditated since my teens. And, you know, I had amazing teachers in that field. But I always placed my happiness outside of myself. So, you know, I'm in a superficial industry and I'm looking to be content and happy. So, of course, what am I looking for? The next big job, you know, the apartment, the dream, you know, the boyfriend, all of those things, you know, and all of those things that are external to me. So I started to go to AA. There was a couple of models who were struggling.
While drinking.
Oh, I gave up drinking loads of times.
Okay.
This is the longest I've been sober in 20 years, and I know I'll never drink again. I mean, I would never, you know, touch wood. I would never, you know, who knows what the future lies ahead for any of us. But the way I'm feeling now, I feel that I would be absolutely bonkers to give up what I have, how I feel, how hard I've worked. But I also don't take chances. I'm going to talk about that as well in a few minutes. But I started to go to AA. A friend of mine is sober 11 years and we were in AA together, but we were in AA for quite a long time together. So maybe she's, yeah, so I suppose maybe I started to go to, I probably was going to AA a little bit longer than that. So I was going to AA, but I remember sitting and I would be sober for a few weeks or a couple of months. And I'd be sitting and that little voice starts to come back and everybody in New York was saying, you know, Ali, you weren't really that bad. You just went through a bad phase, you know, and I suppose they were missing Party Alley and I was missing Party Alley. And it was kind of like taking your medication away without sorting out what the hell else was going on in your life, you know. So I think that's the one thing we do wrong when we deal with addictions is we take the addiction away and we're not dealing with the problem, you know what I mean? Or the rest of our life is in chaos. So I spent many years in AA listening to famous people, not so famous people. AA in New York is quite a show.
I can imagine.
It's like you'd be surprised at the people in it.
I'm itching to ask you, but obviously
I could never tell.
Obviously anonymous means anonymous.
Yeah, anonymous, so, yeah. Exactly. I remember sitting in AA and towards the end, and I know this now because I know my patterns better, towards the time when I knew I was going to have a drink, I would sit in AA and go, yeah, these people are really screwed up. You're actually okay. You're not as bad as them. So you'd start doing this comparison in your head, which is typical, like, the, you know,
justifying it to yourself.
Each addict is totally different. This is what I say about anything I do in life. Every single human being is so different. What works for one doesn't work for another. That's why I have really, truly learned not to try, not to judge people. You know, you just see people judging people all the time. And indeed, when I came out last year and said I was an alcoholic, I got a lot of judgment as well, which I expected because, you know, that's just the way people are. So I went years and years of doing that and I had really bad stages and dips of things going really, really bad. And what was happening was the lows were so low that I needed the highs to be higher. So you're on this roller coaster, you know, and you just don't know how to get off. And it's a horrible place to be. Because you're such good fun when you're out, but nobody's seeing the despair and destruction, you know, that like you wake up the next day, you're so paranoid and full of anxiety and got the fear of God that you don't even have the confidence to walk down to the shop or to go into your casting. And so it did start to affect my health and my skin and all of those type of things. But, you know, I became very good at acting from a very, very young age. Like when I started suffering from depression, I got up in the morning and I put on a really amazingly brave face and I went to do a shoot and I never let myself down from that perspective. But that is absolutely exhausting, like to wake up and go into a shoot and be amazing, you know, and just be the fun Alison everyone knew and be ultra professional, which I was, and get the shoot done, and you go home, you sit in the couch and go, oh my gosh. And it's just like you just finally let go of all of that. So there were definitely, you know, ups and downs, and there were some really dark moments, like in New York. You know, I was rushed to hospital after drinking, and like lots of, like, I remember somebody saying to me last year, and I'm not laughing at this, by the way, I just think how bonkers everything was. Somebody saying to me, oh, when you gave up drink the last time, was that your lowest point? And I'm like, no, there were many points that were much, 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 much lower than that.
So what was the low point? What's the lowest, when you look back now, all the episodes?
Oh, there was loads of low points. I mean, like people say I read books on addiction and people will say I had one really low point. And I'm like, Jesus, what was wrong with me? Like I had so many low points. And, you know, 2 weeks after you have that really low point where you're promising yourself you're never going to drink again, you start to build yourself back up and you feel a bit better and you're
That's the old cliche. Everyone wakes up on a Sunday morning going, oh, I'm never drinking again until Friday night.
When you feel better, you do it again.
If they even manage to get to Friday night.
But like, I never knew when enough was enough. Like when I would go out and say, I'm having 3 glasses of wine. You know, when I would try to be a moderate drinker, moderate drinking to me was an absolute nightmare from hell. And I only realise that now that I'm completely free from that. So I'd have to talk to myself before I go out. I would go to the pub. I'd be sitting with people. I wouldn't be present in anyone's company because I'd have a glass of wine. And a couple of people maybe that were with me would know that maybe I was out the week before and fell over at 6 a.m. and can't remember getting home. And, you know, everybody was giving out to me the next day. So I'm like, oh, you know, I'm not going to drink that much anymore. So I'd be sitting in the pub having my glass of wine and I'd be trying to drink it slowly. And all that would be going through my head would be, is everybody looking at me? Do I think I could have another glass of wine now? Maybe I'll have a glass of water. But in my head, I didn't want to dilute my wine with the water. You know, you're living in, like, I wanted that buzz. So then I would be doing that for hours, which was freaking torture, sitting in front of everyone, you know, doing a really good job. And people would say to me, you're doing really well tonight. See, you can do it. You're well able to do
but
it.
Inside,
you're able.
You're struggling.
But like, I never heard one word that anyone was saying. I wasn't present for the conversation. All I was thinking about was controlling my drinking. Like, there's no fun in that, you know? So I remember then after 3 or 4, I wouldn't give a shit what anyone thought anyway. So that would be when I'd start fighting with people. Or if I'm in my local pub, I'd start going, well, I'm going out anyway. And they'd be like, Alison, you said to say to you, you know, please don't go out. And I'd say, are you going to come into town with me? If you're not going into town with me, I'm going by myself. Don't tell me what to do. You know, I'm a single mother. If I want to have a night out once every 3 weeks, well, I'm entitled to do that. Like, we justify things to ourselves. Like, I deserve this because I work so hard. I deserve this because of X, Y, and Z. And it's like, you know, do you really deserve to go out and get absolutely wasted till 4 in the morning and not remember anything and not remember who you were talking to and not remember how you got home? Like, does anyone deserve that? Deserve doing that to yourself? So I think we have a really bizarre relationship with alcohol in Ireland, and I'm not going to turn into ever being any kind of preacher. But to feel the way I do now and to feel that freedom from something that had me tightly in its grips for nearly 20 years, you know, like this is the longest I haven't had a drink since I was 15. And I just think we're very comfortable with the idea in Ireland that alcoholism is people that have lost their job, their husband, their wife, their children and their home. And that's what an alcoholic is. And that makes people feel better, you know. But I think there are many, many, many functioning alcoholics that not only get up and go to work every day, but are very, very successful.
You were asked a question at a recent event, and you may remember this, you may not, but it struck me your response was instantaneous. And the question was, what's the difference between a binge... It wasn't quite the question, but it was someone asked you a question about binge drinking, not alcoholism. Yeah.
And she asked me, she basically was kind of saying to me, were you just not a binge drinker? She's kind of in her head gone, she's only a binge drinker. She's not an alcoholic. Is that people are very uncomfortable with that word. And maybe that word is deeply. Maybe we should stop using that word and maybe more people would go and get help. You know, maybe if we just started using drink problem, people would go and get help, because this is all about people getting the help they need, you know, not labeling people. And it's interesting because for years and years, I would have said, oh, I'm just a binge drinker. When I go out, I can't stop. But like, that's a story again that we tell ourselves to make ourselves feel better. Like if you go out on a Saturday night and you don't know when the party ends and you just keep wanting another one at the and another one, even when people want you to go home, if you can't remember 4 or 5 hours of the night the next day, if you can't remember going home, you have a drink problem.
It was your answer that really interested me, because your answer was almost instantaneous and you said, what's the difference?
Yeah.
And there was silence in the room.
Oh, there was complete silence.
Well, people kind of thought, oh, where do I fit on that scale?
Yeah.
And you could see the clock's ticking and everyone's head kind of going, oh, maybe she's talking about me.
Yeah.
Because we have a huge problem in this country. Now, I don't want to preach. I've never taken an alcoholic drink in my life.
How did that happen?
I've no idea. It was just one of these things. It's never been a thing for me.
It's amazing.
I got through my teenage years without it, and then I just didn't really see the point. It's not something I really talk about that much, because it's just part of me, and I don't want, like, I've no problem going to the pub and sitting in company or going out to a club, and not so much anymore, but when I was a teenager, when I was in college, I was definitely as social as anybody else. I was just having a Lucozade or a Coke rather than, which probably isn't the worst
for me. It was built into everything. It was built into my confidence. It was built into all my associations. It was built into going out and having a meal. It was built into, for me, I go to lots and lots of events, for example. And when I, oh my God, I remember giving up drink the first time in America and having to go to an event. And I knew nearly everyone there.
Getting handed champagne as you walked the door.
No, it wasn't even the drink. It was the self-esteem. It was walking in and not having that crutch. It nearly killed me. I'll never forget it. I was like, I don't know how to stand. I don't know who to talk to. This is deeply uncomfortable. And we're so conditioned to use alcohol. Like, we associate everything with alcohol, like, you know, birthdays, christenings, weddings, funerals, reward systems. You know, when we put the kids to bed at night, we have a glass of wine in the evening because we deserve it, because we've just looked after the kids for the day. So it has become a reward system for absolutely everything. Take that away and it's pretty bloody scary. It's like, oh, like, how am I going to fit? How am I going to fill that void? And we are filling a void. Like, even if you're having two glasses of wine in the evening, and a lot of people would disagree with me, if you need that two glasses of wine in the evening, you're filling a void. There's a lot of people doing work on food and fitness, and I think it's really, really, really important. Food and fitness is obviously, you know, good food, good mood. Our bodies are made to move. We need to move the energy around our body. But one thing we never hear enough of in Ireland is the inner world and the work we need to do on that. And I think it's something that is not optional anymore. You know, it was kind of considered a privilege years ago to work on yourself and practice self-care. It is, it's something, it's a must for absolutely everybody. And in a way that's like, if we all take care of ourselves and practice self-care, we are going to be better sisters, mothers, fathers, friends, husbands, wives, parents. You know, it makes us better people. And we need to nurture that inner world, because our inner world is actually what reflects what's going on outside. So that's the one thing I've learned through all of this. And most people say to me, how are you sober this time? So I was doing the work for many years before I finally kicked the drink for good. And I've been on this path of self-development and spiritual development for a long time, even before I had James. James kind of just accelerated it for me and really made me dig deep and look at myself. But I have been, had many great teachers in New York and everything, spiritual teachers. And this is something that always fascinated me. But I was still, like most people, I wanted the shortcut, you know, because to do the work sometimes can be a pain in the ass, you know. And when people want to change and they want to feel better and they want to do better and they want better things in their life. But when you suddenly realize that you have to really work for that, suddenly it's like, maybe I'll just stay where I am in low level lying pain. And most people in the world live in a world of low level pain all the time, consistent low level pain. And what I mean by that is that, you know, things keep happening and they're frustrated and they're not really happy in their job and they're not really happy with various different elements that are going on in their life. And that's going to continue unless you change something. And I speak to people every day who are like, but I did this for 3 months. And I'm like, yeah, but what did you do after the 3 months? You went back to the way things were. So if you want to stay sober, if you want to change your life, if you want to be happier, if you want to be more productive, you have to work on yourself every single day. It's a 365-day a year job. Like, I would never take a risk now. I would never take a day off from, I wake up in the morning, I meditate, I write my gratitude journal. I have a, you know, whatever statement I want for the day, an affirmation or I set an intention. And then I always, always, always listen to a motivational speaker and I always every day read something new. They're my rules. Every single solitary day. And if I didn't do that, I probably wouldn't be sober. I probably wouldn't be as happy as I am. And on the days where I don't feel like doing it, I do more of it. So on the days where I feel like this week, you know, I'm a human being. On Tuesday, I was like, I don't really feel like writing that article. I'm feeling a bit low today. So I just went, get your ass out, go for a walk. I listened to Les Brown. He would kick your ass if anybody would. Or I'd listen to Tony Robbins or I'd listen to Abraham Hicks. I listen to any motivational speaker. When I'm in the car, I listen to podcasts from motivational speakers. I constantly feed my soul and my spirit with motivation, with good information. I eat books. I read and read and read and read. And I just think the work will never end and can never end if I want to stay here. And I wouldn't give up what I have for anything because I lived in hell for 20 years.
You talk about what you have right now and we've kind of taken a bit of a detour around a certain part of your life. And I want to rewind a bit because you mentioned James.
Yeah.
So 28 years of age, living the life. Sorry, not 28 years of age. You moved to New York.
When I was about 25, I think.
So late 20s, early 30s, you're in New York, you're living on Central Park West. And life has everything. And then you find that maybe things haven't quite worked out to plan. Mm-hmm. And life has been set in a different direction. And that's, I suppose, where James comes into
Well, I broke up with my boyfriend. I was obviously very upset. It was a very long-term relationship. And I came home to Ireland just to try and figure out what I was going to do. My apartment was being sublet in New York while I was living out in San Fran with him. And I didn't know, like, my plans had just been turned upside down, you know. So I knew there was no going back to the relationship. This is the umpteenth time that we had tried to make things work. And it just wasn't working, clearly. And I discovered I was expecting. So it was unexpected. Like, you know, obviously I was shocked at the time. You know, I'll try and answer all the people's questions listening to this. Goes, does she not know about protection? Does she not know about contraception? Yes, everyone. I was on the pill. So, and religiously taking it every day because I knew it was a relationship I didn't want to be in. So there's all of those things as well. So be careful if you're taking antibiotics or other medication. I always say that to girls. It's the first thing people say. And you know what? I used to say those things too. You know, since my plan wasn't to wake up one day and go, oh, I think I'll be a single mom, move back to Ireland, live with my mother and then go on social welfare when he's born. You know, that's what I'm going to do with my life. But that's what happened. And it was a really tough journey for me because I was living with mom, couldn't afford to live on my own. And I was trying to kind of keep up, you know, I suppose somewhat of a facade. Like, I don't ever feel like I was disingenuous or like I'm not dishonest in any way. Do you know what I mean? So there was nothing ever kept a secret. But when I was living with mom, I needed to go on loan parents. I wasn't earning. So I went up. That was no problem. But there was a girl up in the social welfare office that just had it in for me from day one.
There's always one,
isn't
there?
Oh, my God. And she used to call me up with a list of, say, press cuttings or anything I'd be at. And she would want my agent to give her, you know, a details list of things and money. Details. And I used to say to her, do you really, like, I'd be bawling, crying. And I used to say, do you really think I would put my career in jeopardy? Like, if I'm going to try and screw the system, by the way, people are going to find out. It's going to be in the newspapers. Like, why would I do that for €200 a week? I wouldn't do it if I didn't need it.
I'm getting what you think I'm getting from this. I don't need this money.
So I very luckily got a job with the Daily Mail and they were paying me €300 a week and I was earning, I think, €40 more a week than I was allowed as a single mother and I lost my lone parents. So that was devastating because I had just moved into this little cottage and I was really struggling then. I couldn't pay my rent. So I ended up owing my friends, my family, my sister, my mom, money left, right and centre because I desperately had just moved out of mom's and I wanted to stay in my own home and I thought, oh God, I can't go back to mom's again because I just feel I'll never get out, you know. And after living on your own and having such an amazing career for so long, like it was so many different stages of acceptance.
In your 30s.
I had to go to and all of that. Like, how did this happen to me? But I do now kind of just think everything that happened to me was a blessing. I think, like most people, I'm one of those human beings where you have to lose everything to rebuild and to really understand what life is about. And during that process, I really started to work on myself and I really started to, you know, research mental health and diet and nutrition and, you know, mindset and how I felt. And on that journey, I had some amazing therapists and coaches and everything. And they really kind of dug deeper into how little I thought of myself. And it was really when one guy said to me, you have no self-esteem and you don't value yourself at all. And of course, what you do when you're in therapy, how dare you? And blah, 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 because they've touched a nerve. And I had never, ever thought about that before. I'd never thought it the way I talk to myself. And we never do, like, wake up in the morning and go, oh God, look at my skin and my hair looks like shit today. And those jeans look awful on you. And, you know, you're starting your day off by saying all of these negative things to yourself. And that's what I did every single day as a model. I got up and critiqued myself. Like, it was very rare I got up and went, oh, you look amazing today. Let's go get the job. Very rare. I would always be able to find 4 or 5, 6 things that were wrong with me.
But surely the more you strive for perfection, the more faults you find.
Yeah. And when you're in a negative frame of mind, like, it everything feeds into each other. You know, and now what I know about vibration and energy and everything that I've studied is that our words are so powerful to ourselves and how we feel and our energy, and you attract what you are and all of those type of things. So I started to work on how I spoke to myself, and I started to use affirmations, and I had things written all over the house and post-its actually all over this kitchen and in the bathroom and in everything, and just worked on it every single solitary day. And, you know, I have not stopped working on it since, because I'm full of hope, not only for myself, but for everyone else out there who thinks that they're stuck in their story. I cannot tell you the amount of times I was told, this is just the way life is for you. You'll always be in medication, or you'll always suffer from anxiety. Like, and you know, you become what people tell you you are. And none of us are stuck in our story. Like, none of us are even stuck in our story of, you know, oh, this happened to me as a child and it's my mother's fault. Like, I was the victim for years. If I didn't get a job, it was my agent's fault, it was my sister's fault, it was my mother's fault, it was my boyfriend's fault. It was always somebody else's fault, but never mine, you know. And taking that level of personal responsibility is, I found it very, very difficult in the beginning, because you have to be willing to see things about yourself that are pretty nasty and pretty ugly. And you have to sit with them, and you have to deal with them, and you have to, like I always say, you know, in the modern world, you're not allowed to have negative feelings. We need to fix them really quickly. You know, if you present with negative feelings, well, you're not allowed to have those negative feelings. So if you can't get rid of them, we're gonna do something. We're going to medicate you. But you have to get rid of them, because not only is it uncomfortable for them, but it's uncomfortable for everybody around you, you know. And we live in a world of contradictions and contrasts, and negative feelings are so important. They're just as important as positive ones. They're there to show us what we don't want. They're there to show us when we're in danger. They're warning signs, you know, and we need to really feel into them. And the only reason I really healed this time was because I really felt into those emotions and really dug deep and really explored why I felt like that. And it was deeply uncomfortable. But I do believe that any kind of change that happens, you have to go somewhere and you have to do the work, and usually you have to hit some kind of, you know, wall that you have to break through, and there's no other way around it. I have very rarely met anyone who started to work on themselves who hasn't had a struggle, but most people give up when you hit that struggle. You're like, I didn't buy into this. I bought into changing my life and feeling better, not feeling worse. But you can't expect to feel better unless you've dealt with the stuff that's caused you to be there in the first place. You know, you have to go back. You have to deal with the emotions that are buried. You have to go in and figure out, why am I behaving like this? What caused this? Why am I depressed? Why do I not value myself? Why do I not want to put good food in my mouth? Is it that I just don't know, or is that I just don't care? And in my case, it was that I just didn't care about myself enough. If I had to swim where I shoot on a Friday and my self-esteem was low, I would go and order a pizza, like self-sabotage, just to make myself feel worse, you know? And then after the pizza, I'd feel really shitty. So it's this kind of cycle of self-abuse, and it can present itself in so many different ways, in how I let boyfriends treat me. I let boyfriends treat me like a piece of crap, the way they spoke to me. You know, I wouldn't let anybody speak to me the way my ex-boyfriend spoke to me. But, you know, I didn't value myself, so I kind of thought that was my worth. And they could see that. So there's a lot of lessons kind of that I've learned, you know. I've learned that I'm not a victim, and to get over that, even though sometimes I feel like settling into a pity party, you know, because I'm a human being. But, you know, it is very powerful to know that you're not a victim, that you can change your story. That doesn't mean that life becomes blissful and amazing, but it certainly means that you will have a better chance of being happier and healthier. And, you know, really, when we're honest with ourselves, that's what we all want.
You found yourself in a situation just after James was born where you weren't happy at all. You were struggling with just being a new mum. And that's, I suppose, where the book Minding Mum came from. Tell us a little bit about that story.
So I thought I was going to be a great mum. And I am a great mum, actually.
Everybody thinks they're going to be fantastic.
I am a great mum. I think all mums are great, because we're great in the ways we know how. But everybody always told me when I was a kid, like, I was always dumped with the kids. Don't mean it like that, but it's like, if I was at a party, oh, Alison's great with kids, give Alison all the kids. And I was trusted with kids from a very young age. And I absolutely love children. I love children. I love being around kids. So I kind of thought to myself when I was pregnant, this could potentially be the one thing that you're freaking awesome at. Do you know what I mean? So I was really excited to have James. And when he came, all was amazing. But I pushed myself. I felt like I had a lot to prove. You know, I was a single mom. I was really panicked about trying to, you know, how am I going to feed him? How am I going to buy nappies? At the time, I remember, was the most scary thing, because nappies were so expensive. And that's, like, so sincerely honest. I just remember, like, the Pampers were so expensive. And I remember going, oh my God, okay. And, you know, even Lidl and Aldi and everything. But just there were things that I used to panic about before they happened. So I went back to work 10 days after I had James.
Wow.
And I really, but I felt great at the time. That's the thing, Brefany. Like,
are we talking modelling?
Modelling. And I felt great. And, you know, I had the baby with me and I was feeding the baby on the jobs. But what happened was I kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And in the beginning as a new mom, you're feeding off adrenaline. You know, so you're able to keep going, keep going, keep going. And I was up in the middle of the night and I was getting up and I was kind of organizing shows and I had all these great ideas. And I pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and I missed all the warning signs and I hit complete burnout. And I ended up with really bad postnatal depression. Everything came crashing down. And that started the real journey of, it was really interesting because when the doctor said to me, you know, about antidepressants and a prescription, I suddenly went, oh God, I'm feeding my baby. I don't want to pass anything on to them. That was the first time in my life I ever even
thought about what
I was putting into my body.
I want to rewind a little bit. Yeah, we're going to talk about the depression and all that stuff afterwards. But 10 days after you gave birth, you were at work as a model.
Yeah.
Now, nowadays, that will be all over the news if someone like Victoria Beckham has a baby and she's seen 2 weeks later. To most women, getting up and having time to take a shower, and never mind going to a photo shoot, How did you manage that in your own head?
Not great. They sent over clothes, I remember, for me to try and squeeze into. And I remember I was trying to squeeze into these clothes that they sent over. And, you know, it was an awful lot of pressure. I mean, my body changed an awful lot and I'm very tall. So I did actually put on quite a bit of weight for me, even though people might have not visibly seen it. But like I didn't get back into my jeans for well over a year and a half. Like it was a long time. Do you know what I mean? So, I definitely didn't feel 100%, but like, I had just spent 20 years faking it, so I was going to get up and do the same thing, you know. But it was the one time that I just thought about how stupid my job was. Like, when you think about it, your job determines whether you can fit into those jeans or not, and that means you'll either get paid or you won't. So it was the first time I went, God, I have a really stupid job, don't I, you know, especially when you're after having a baby. And I can kind of see the humour in all this now when I look back on it, but
not at the time when you were not at the time,
you know. But like now I can see the chaos and the craziness and the lunacy and the way I behaved and how not normal any of it was. And really, the whole way along this journey, I found information. Things have changed an awful lot in 6 years. Let me just say that. Like when I went looking for information on postnatal depression, body image, anything to do with moms, there was no Mummy Pages, Her Family. There was no Mumsnet. There was none of those websites 6 years ago. Like, just look at how fast things have changed. So I went looking for any kind of information on mums. And I always say I went over to Oxford Street. I was back and forward to London. And I went into the bookshop and it was a huge bookshop. And I said, do you have books for moms? And she goes, oh, we've loads. And I was like, oh my God, deadly. She took me over to a whole section. I think she was even terrified because at this point I was close to tears all the time. You know, I was so fragile. And I was like, they're all about the baby. And she's like, well, who are you looking for a book for? I'm like, for a mom. Like, I want to know how I feel. And she was like, oh, no, we've no books like that. And I thought, oh my God, isn't that amazing? There's 50,000 books for a mum while she's pregnant to look after herself. And then when you have a baby, there's 50,000 books about the baby, but no books for a new mom.
Yeah.
None on like how she's feeling or what she might be going through. So it just started this journey of why don't we value moms? Why don't we care about moms? Why don't we place emphasis on them post-birth? And I do believe, with all the research I've done and everything that I've been working on, that if we focus more on our mothers post-birth, well, then the babies will naturally be taken care of. If our mums are strong and healthy mentally and physically and emotionally in every other way, well, then they'll naturally be well able to look after the baby.
It's the age-old thing we hear in every single safety announcement, every time you get on the plane, like put on your own air supply before you look after any children or people who needed help. So you got to look after yourself before you look after others. So tell us about Minding Mum.
So Minding Mum is a book that is what I like to call my concept on health and well-being, which is looking at the full 360. So it's connecting the dots for ourselves. So there's a chapter on postnatal depression, of course. There's a chapter on the early days and what to expect emotionally and physically. There's, you know, a chapter on nutrition and some great healthy, you know, ideas, and all my recipes are in there. This chapter on exercise and the various different types of exercise. There's a chapter on meditation. There's 3 meditations on my website that you can take down. And there's a chapter on gratitude. But it covers kind of absolutely, there's 10 different chapters on everything. It covers everything, you know, it covers the inner world, the outer world, it covers your feelings. And, you know, it's not a manual. It's kind of more my journey, what I have discovered, you know, things that you could try. Some people, some things will work for some people, some won't. You know, I have a Minding Mum group. There's about 600 of us now. And I do weekly live meditations in there. And it enables the mums to take 20 minutes for themselves when they can't leave the house. So what they do is they get the kids to bed at night and they can come online at 9:30 with me for 20 minutes or a half an hour and do some meditation. And I've had amazing response and feedback from
that. That's so simple, but yeah, brilliant.
Yeah. And you know what? It's just giving them, it's mums giving themselves that 20 minutes once a week.
Where can people find out about that?
It's on Facebook. So okay. It's Minding Mum. Okay. The group is, and they can ask to join and I'll let them in, but
maybe
yeah, no, of course I will. But it's just something that I felt really benefits me. Like I will speak about the benefits of meditation till the cows come home. I just think it's so important. Not only do I meditate every day, but I check in with myself 3 or 4 times a day. Like I was on my way to a meeting this morning and I was doing my breathing in the car. So yes, it's taken quite a long time for these to become daily habits, but if you stick with them, they do become habits. So I was doing my 4-7-8 breath, you know, which I do 2 or 3 times a day. And I do that because it helps to keep my stress levels low, my blood pressure. It helps to keep my central nervous system in check. So I do it every single day, even when I feel great, you know, just to keep myself in check. So for me, it's all about prevention. Like I haven't suffered from anxiety in a very long time. I think last year I had a bit of anxiety not long after the book came out and I went in a retreat to a couple of amazing teachers. But I'm a great believer in the power of meditation, the power of taking that time for yourself, that space that none of us have, that we all need, you know, for to listen to ourselves, to listen to our inner being, to listen for that guidance. You know, if you don't give yourself that space, how do you really know what's going on within yourself?
It's funny because I get asked that question a lot when I go off and do my adventures, whether it's on a bike or whether it's just walking through the hills. But I get so much time and people are like, what do you do it all the time? And I'm just like, I think it's, yeah. I do meditation from time to time, not as much as I'd like to. I tried yoga, couldn't quite get into the class schedule or that, but I do intend to go back.
Do it at home, Adrian, Yoga with Adrian. She's amazing on YouTube.
I'll have to check that out.
Oh, she's incredible.
But in my hands, I have your gratitude journal,
yes.
Which I know we spoke at an event in Athlone a couple of weeks ago, and this was like the biggest winner.
I know,
of the
and
week.
It was gone. It was gone. Sorry to everybody who didn't get it.
You
I
ran
need
out
to
of
make
them.
More.
Yeah,
I did.
You ran out of them.
Really
so
quickly.
It's phenomenal, but it's so simple.
Yeah. So this is all science, backed by science. I suppose when I started meditating, when I started, you know, doing all of this stuff, there was no science to back it up. So everybody thought it was hippy dippy, and it's something I kind of kept to myself, actually, you know, for many, many years, because I'm the type of person that does angel cards and, you know, has crystals everywhere and all over her office and travel with crystals and everything. So I've always been big into all of those things. But gratitude for me has been a game changer. When I was recovering from postnatal depression, there was a lady called Madge Fogarty, actually, from PND.ie. And she told me to write down the things I was achieving every day in a journal. And I have been doing it ever since for, you know, probably 5.5 years.
So just so listeners obviously have
so
that
basically,
in their hands.
Gratitude, when you're in a state of appreciation, it's impossible to be negative, you know, and there's always something to be grateful for no matter what's going on in your life. So our brains are primitive and primal, you know, and they naturally lean towards being in a more negative state of mind. That's just what they naturally will do. So you have to consciously put them and help them to flow in a more positive direction. So I consciously start my day by choosing. So the most recent science, which is amazing, Sean Aker is the professor of happiness in Harvard. And he says that choosing three different things each day and writing down what they are and why you're grateful for them. It helps to retrain the brain. So it's all about neuroplasticity. It's about neurons that fire together, wire together. And, you know, it's retraining that brain. So between meditation and gratitude, you're increasing the gray and white matter in your brain. So you're actually changing and altering the structure of your brain. And doing that daily brain training will help you to naturally be in a more positive frame of mind. So what you start to do is you start to notice the good things happening in the world and not the bad things. But
there's lots of bad things at the moment.
Yeah, there's loads of bad things. But you know what? Like I always say, Trump is not living in my home. He doesn't decide whether I'm in a good or bad mood.
I wasn't specifically talking about him, but he seems to be the first thing that comes up whenever anyone talks about bad things.
I suppose, look, like when I was in America, he owned a modeling agency. Like I know a very different Trump. I'm just like, think it's bizarre that he's the president of the United States of America. But then again, you know, there's also this is the whole thing. There's so much that's within our control. Like, you often hear people saying, but what can I do? But what can I do? Well, look at what happened when a third of Americans didn't vote. There's an awful lot you can do. But not only just from that perspective, but from the energy that you're putting out into the world. So, you know, on social media, be careful what you're indulging in and commenting on. And there's so much that we can do, you know, ourselves. And I always, always, always say in this world, we live in a global world where we always see kind of this huge, big stage where our part seems so small and so insignificant. You know, we want to lead well, but we're never going to get there. We're only ever going to be an extra. And it's really important to know that there's people in my life, and I've seen it in other people's lives, one or two people, that have changed my life. Like, people I've met who have no idea how much they've changed my life.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, perfectly. And when, never ever underestimate the power that one person can have in another person's life. On a day-to-day basis, by smiling at someone, by giving someone a hand, by buying a homeless person a cup of coffee, like, by just showing some small act of kindness. And what that does on the world stage is it helps that energy of kindness to grow. And people that are not into energy might think that I am now bonkers, but it's just so true. The energy that you put out into the world is the energy that will help increase. And it's also the energy that you'll get back. So there's a lot more to it than we think.
Absolutely. I always finish the show with more or less the same question. So if the listeners to this show collectively or individually could do one thing for you, if you had one ask of them, what would it be?
Be kinder.
That's it?
To yourself, yeah. To yourself and other people, be kinder. We desperately need kindness in this world. Okay. You know.
Well, listen, Alison Canavan.
Thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time and for looking after us in this morning in your lovely house. I won't say where it is. But,
you're very welcome.
Yeah, but thank you very much. And best luck in whatever happens.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.